Hello and welcome to A Vague Idea. This is a podcast at the moment. That's about all we can say because we don't have the game show thing going on, but we have been talking about a combination of things we've been watching during quarantine and talking to interesting people about things that they're passionate about. This week's episode will be from the latter category. And with me, as always, no Shannon this week, but she will be back. Don't worry, guys. Otherwise, you get me, which I guess is good, depending on, I don't know. Mike, what do you think? Is just talking to me good enough?
I'm a Shannon stan, so yeah. I'm a little bummed she's not here. I was excited to meet her. It feels like she really balances you out, cuts you down a little, so maybe I'll try to do that.
Okay, yeah, good. You can be the proto-Shannon. I like Shannon stan as a thing, too.
It's fun linguistically.
Yeah, which, I mean, that ties perfectly. You set me up for an amazing story, Mike. So first off, guys, our guest this week is Mike Gravano. He is a poet, a writer, a podcast host, a podcast guest, an event host, and someone who I met through 1888, which is an organization in California, where we both were doing a lot of work one way or the other. I was doing stuff freelance remote here from Denver, and Mike, you were there.
I was there, yeah.
Lots of events, because you hosted a lot of live podcasts and other event series stuff. Mike Gravano, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It's happy to be here. And it's fun now that I moved to Denver where we met, but we still have to do this remote. We could have done this when I lived in California. But
we got the beautiful opportunity to have one evening of beer and salsa.
Yeah.
Oh no, the world ended.
Sorry. I mean, we're gonna hang out all the never. We're gonna hang out all the never. And that's it. I just moved, my wife and I just moved here, so it really does. We actually feel more social now because everybody wants to hang out virtually. We didn't have time to make friends, and then everybody's like, you can't anyway. So
it's fine. There are no physical friends.
No.
There's only the beautiful distance of screens. The what we're gonna talk about this week is poetry, which is something that I know is near and dear to both of us.
Yes.
I've written a lot of poetry in my life. I wouldn't call myself a poet because I know people who are way better at it than I am and probably will ever be. But yeah.
I don't know if skill is it. I also have a problem with calling myself a poet. And I've had stuff published, which is, I was going to say humble brag, but I guess just a brag. Or it is just a fact. Like I've been lucky enough to have things published, but I still feel very new.
That it was really burdensome to have to deal with all the publishing process.
The edits.
Oh, man.
The free copies. But yeah, I think if you write poetry, you're a poet. Like, part of why I like all the things I like is fuck labels.
Yeah. Yeah. Ironic that you're wearing a Sub Pop hat right now.
Yeah.
It's a good label. Not a fuck
label. Yeah, it's a good label. No.
Yeah, no, I think you make a good point, too, because most of my... any poetry that I've really done kind of teeters in that weird liminal space. Like I had submitted a poem that's for a book it's called Thought for Food. One of the wonderful poets in Denver, Bryce Mayero's South Broadway Press is putting it together. It's to donate money to for food organizations and stuff.
Awesome.
But the poem is a haiku. Well, it's a haiku sandwich. So I have two haikus and then just a prose rant in the middle about how basically mad I am that we had such a ripe opportunity that with the right leadership, you would have gone full FDR and said, hey, a lot of people are unemployed and we have all these problems. What if we fix those things by employing them through the government to move food to where to end users so that it doesn't just get thrown away?
Now, I really get off in watching tons and tons and mountains and thousands of dollars worth of food rot while people are starving. So I thought I'd never see it in my lifetime, so I'm pretty stoked.
Yeah, well, yeah, what's the name of your sexual proclivity? I can't remember. It's not like a boar thing, but
it's not a boar thing, but it's rotophilia, let's say.
Yeah. People just watching that milk get poured out into a gutter on the side of the road. Wow, hot. So I'm with you. Labels are interesting, especially because throughout the history of poetry, I mean, anybody who's really read it or studied it at all knows that there aren't really rules. I mean, there are rules, but then there aren't really rules. And some of the best poetry I've ever read is the stuff that, you know, it's not about rhyme scheme. It's not about meter. It's about conveying an experience through lush language or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As long as it's like shorter and you're trying to not obfuscate, but definitely like hit at the emotion and distill a thing versus like, I'm going to tell you exactly everything always. Like Walt Whitman, who is like America's early big poet, right? The America's poet or whatever. That shit is not short. It is not punchy. It is like, but he could have written novels upon novels upon novels, but he distilled his stories in his way of distillation, which is still pretty fucking long.
Oh yeah. I mean, like Leaves of Grass is basically a novel. Just
yeah.
Chapters are written in verse rather than in, you know, standard block text. So, yeah. So let's talk just like you write poetry.
Yes.
Like how is it a common part of your life, or is it something that just sort of happens now?
It's changed. Like I started, like many of us did, as an angry, angsty punk rock kid in Southern California. So I called them lyrics then, because that sounded cooler than I write poems. But I was never in a band. I have a very bad voice, but I was a lyricist. And then I kind of fell out of that and hated poetry and got into nonfiction writing. And then I kept being like, anything past the 70s of poetry is dumb. What's the point? It's all been done. And then a friend gave me Prelude to Bruise by Saeed Jones. He's like, read this and shut up. And it changed my life.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, and so I try to shout out Prelude to Bruise by Saeed Jones as much as I can, because it's amazing. And then I just fell into the world. And I think any niche, whether it's fine art or poetry or whatever, there's so much of it. There's so much of it out there. And we don't really, it's not that mainstream. So there's so much bad stuff too. So you really do need that Obi-Wan to be like, no, check this out. I'm going to guide you through this new world. Because if you just try, like, I'm going to read poems, you're going to find a lot of bad stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you shop for poetry on the end cap at a Barnes and Noble, you're going to run into mostly celebrity poetry that is
right.
Not good writing, but it sells books, right?
Right.
You brought up song lyrics, and that was actually one of the things that I want to talk about, because I think really like song lyrics in the musical form or just reading them, and often I'm one of those people who I tend to really fall in love with the music of a song,
mm-hmm.
and the lyrics are something that maybe even 30 years later I finally listen and go, oh, that's what they were saying.
Should I say I love that song? Because that's, yeah.
Not what I expected. This is about a guy who's sexually aroused by food waste. Song at all.
I'm into that one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. But I think what's interesting is like I in high school we had in one of my, maybe it was AP English, maybe it was the prepping for AP English class, but we had to do a project about music as poetry, right? As song lyrics as poetry. And one of the things I remember most is I worked with one of my friends in that class on, she wanted to do a Beatles song, and I was like, well, you should do A Day in the Life, because it's a really interesting, like it's an interesting piece of writing just on its own, right? Because there's this sort of historical poetry, and then you have this this inversion in the bridge where Paul is sort of pretending like, oh, well, everything's just normal, like it's two times on the same thing. And I guess the thing is I think that anybody who thinks they don't like poetry probably listens to music, so we all like poetry just by proxy.
Like
if you could set Whitman, for that matter. If you could set Walt Whitman to music, do you think people would like it better? Or do you think people would connect with
him? Yeah, because there's suddenly you have all these other colors to paint with, because I couldn't think of a poetic analogy. So like, yeah, and so you're like, if I read this line, I don't know whether he wants me to be happy or sad, because we're not used to like really trying in close reading when we're reading day to day. Now the bright tones are telling me, oh, this is a happy part. And then it'll go into minor key and you're like, ah, he is sad. He saw that person dying in the sea. And so, yeah, I think that would help people connect much more to music. And I could definitely see, yeah, Whitman being either folky or like Ginsberg in a grindcore band.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like Howl could be just an epic, like 14 minute long fucking punk song.
Exactly.
Like just hard with just crazy, just like slapping at the power chords. So, and yeah, like, I mean, Whitman could pretty easily be set to, you know, James Taylor music, or, you know, even Bob Dylan for that matter. I mean, Dylan is kind of Whitman in musical form anyway.
Long
lyrics and stories that are pretty well fleshed out in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I remember hearing that. Like, I was like shortly in choir, like in the third grade, and them saying we learned Bob Dylan. That music teacher was very into music of the '60s, which I think for third graders in the '90s didn't connect that well. But him being like, "Oh yeah, he's a poet, he's a musician." Again, not going to win third graders over. And two, he was like, "Cause he's like, where have all the flowers gone? The flowers, guys, they're not flowers he's talking about." And even at that age, I was like, "Doesn't all music?" Isn't that just every song you're talking about? Like, it's very few songs are like, I mean exactly this as I'm singing.
Yeah. It's the songs you write when you're a teenager that usually mean exactly the thing.
Yes. Zero subtext.
Why didn't you want to go to the dance with me? I it's interesting because I think like poetry gets this bad rap of being, you know, it's not really lucrative. It's not an economical path. Mm-hmm. You're not going to hear anybody say, "Oh, you really got to major in poetry. Get that master's of fine arts in poetry."
Right.
Go off and become one of those wealthy poets we all know about.
Yeah, every state and the country has a poet laureate, which is like the biggest. And still, we don't know that. Like, right. Nobody knows who that is.
No, I mean, I see the article for who Colorado's is now and again, and I never remember it. I don't commit it to memory because there's just too many.
Yes.
But I think it's interesting because it's something like, just to your point, like poetry is so pervasive in culture. I mean, to an extent that most of advertising is poetry.
Yes.
Right? Like it's all about how can I condense feeling and thought and associations into a statement to force people to think, I really, you know what? I do need to buy somebody a Coke. Like that's have to do because it means that I'm an American and I'm loving and I'm a human and I'm ready to embrace a peaceful and free world.
Yeah, that you have 40 characters to make somebody feel a thing and do a thing, and that is poetry. And that's my background was stand-up comedy and my day job is advertising, and then I fell into poetry. And yeah, it's all about economy of words and making people do and feel things, and the sheer tyrannical power of that is really what I like.
I like the tyrannical power. It's just We're just all waiting to long mwahaha laugh after we've landed something. Yeah, why do you think? I mean, I guess my question for you, and this is not a question that maybe we can answer specifically, but it's like why is it that we would simultaneously say that something is not valuable? Because I think most people would say like writing poems isn't going to get you anywhere. I mean, it's still really like I have friends who are incredible poets. And I always buy their chapbooks, but I also know like chapbooks don't, that's not going to pay the rent. This is like this is more of a, it is just art. It is art for art's sake in a lot of cases. So why is it that something that is so culturally pervasive, like that because we live like marketing and advertising and really most of the way that we even conceive of the world. I mean, hip hop and rock and all kinds of music are all this. And yet poetry isn't a thing that we revere we don't revere it in the same way that we might even revere like painting, right? Like if you went into painting as a fine artist, you'd probably get more, people would be like, wow, you're good and this will go places.
Yeah, you'd, even though so many of us looking at the, well, I told that was a good painting, I'm going to just stare at it for long enough that people think I get it. I think fine art and poetry are similar. I think a few things there, so starting with fine art v poetry, is everybody thinks they can write. This is my experience as a writer in several different ways, but especially in the day job as a copywriter, everybody thinks they can write, so that's devalued because somebody reads it and like, well, I know those words, I could put those words in that order. Versus painting, even if you don't get it, you're like, well, I know I cannot do that. I can't draw a straight line with a ruler, so I could not do that, which means that is valuable. But words, even though not everybody can, everybody thinks they can drive well, everybody thinks they're funny, and everybody thinks they just know how to put words in the right order, and it's not true.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Because writing in general is devalued in as much as, what I think is interesting is that on one hand, everybody thinks they can write, but on another hand, I think most people just I think most people think that they, if they just sat down and had the time, they could do it.
Right.
In the same way that one might say, oh, you know, I could do 100 push-ups. No problem. Why would that even be hard? That doesn't seem hard. Look at how hard one is, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
And part of why I like poetry and part of why I like push-ups, I'm kind of a bro-y poet. I'm a bro-it.
and you know it.
Is because, yes, if you put in that time, you can do it. Like, there's something I find very punk rock about poetry. And it's like, just sit there and put in the time. Like, start shitty. And then cut away and edit and, like, feel real bad about yourself until it's less shitty. Like, that's, I think that's very cool.
Yeah, that's really kind of the truth of all. I mean, it's true for all writing, but poetry is bite-sized enough that you can make progress in short. Mm-hmm. If you write a whole novel and then you're like, oh wait, I got to go through. I've written 1,000 pages, and 776 of these are superfluous, and then you have to go through and pick those, right? But at least if it's a 10-line poem, you go, wow, 4 of these lines I don't even need because it's still there without those. And yeah, I think it's a good exercise because it's actually, I mean, I would encourage anybody to just sit down and write a poem a day just for the fun of it.
Yeah, there's a poet out of Anaheim, California, Grant Heyer, who I think is either the Anaheim or Orange County Poet Laureate, actually. But he, as like a dare with like 30 friends at first, they're like, let's do a poem a day for the next month. And a bunch dropped off. And then a few of them were like, let's do 6 months because the 15 of us got through the first. And people whittled away. And now he's like 4 years into a poem a day.
Damn.
And only he's been left for the last 3 years, right? But it's muscles, right? So once you start doing it, that's very easy to do. It's hard to get there.
Oh, sure. Well, because I think it's sort of like, okay, because step one of any kind of writing endeavor, but especially with poetry, seems to be figuring out how to observe the world and your emotions, right? So I think there's probably just months of work potentially for some folks just to be like, what am I actually feeling and why am I feeling it and how am I feeling it? And then to put that into words.
Right.
Because you can't really write compellingly in any way if you can't figure out why you felt a certain way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And like often my press is often like the rhythm of a line will get stuck in my head or I want to write something out, but like, and I'll hand it to a friend. And he's like, yeah, but what's it about? And I'm like, oh, you're right. This is dog shit. Cause right now it is just words that sonically sound fun together.
Yeah.
Or he'll tell me, cause I do have one friend. It's the same friend who gave me the original book of poetry years ago. And he'll be like, oh, it's about this. I'm like, oh shit. Now I can guide it. But like, I do think like there's so many barriers to get rid of them. So you're like, I don't know what to write about. All right, just write anything. Like, and I think that's connected to going back to like, why isn't poetry bigger? Introspection is not big in this day and age. I think self-care and self-help are buzzwords and people talk about it, but nobody actually wants to look in the mirror and say why they suck.
Yeah, that's true. You'd rather pay somebody to tell you that what you need to do is XYZ.
Right.
That you're actually a perfect, fully formed thing and you just need to embrace that. I hear you.
So it's that plus like when we learn poetry, it's like Poe and Shakespeare mostly, right? In most primary schools, public schools, whatever.
Sure.
And there's so much out there. So, and you're like, these are the rules and only these rules. And it feels all you're doing is scansion and like figuring out the iambic pentameter. And that stuff is pretty boring. Poetry was bigger than fiction until the 50s. So something shifted. So like books of poetry outsold novels. And then, but I do think there's a contemplative sense that seems to, and I'm not 80 years old, so I wasn't alive back then, but I don't want to be like, this generation sucks, because I'm a pretty big fan. I think poetry seems to be bubbling. But something dramatically shifted in like introspection and contemplation and the quiet.
Yeah, I would say that I agree with you 100%. I think that probably the reason why poetry, from that perspective, is not as popular in this day and age is because in a time when maybe you didn't have a television, you only had a radio, And the art of sitting and reading in your living room or your study or whatever was something that was there. Like, poetry is this easily digestible, consumable thing, right? A novel, you really have to be able to invest hours in, probably. Yeah. Even if you're only going to read a chapter, depending on the novel, you're putting in probably 20 minutes. And poetry is sort of the little, just the punchy snippets, right? It's, yeah. I can read four poems in 15 minutes and go on with my evening, right? And then to have the time, because you don't have other stuff to distract you, to sit with it, mm-hmm. think about what it means. Because one of my favorite classes in college was just doing analysis on poetry and really going line by line. And, well, what does this mean? What does this mean in relation to this? Why this word?
Right.
Love that, because because we don't think about our word choice in common conversation very often. And more often than not, when we get into arguments with people, whether they're significant others, friends, strangers, it's word choice.
Yeah.
Tone too, but it's word choice. Like, if you had said something differently, you could have conveyed it in a completely different way. And poetry is so beautifully about conveying it to bring on, you know, to invoke a bunch of emotion.
Right. And I think that's like why I used to hate it. There's a lot of reasons I used to hate it, but like one of it was like, it could mean anything.
Right.
But I think that's a bad poem. Like, we can interpret them as everything, but the poet better have an intention and the line better like point in at least several directions. But the minute you're like, it means anything, it doesn't matter. You said the important part at the end there, then it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, and that's, I think that is the crutch. I think most of the easy poetry, the easy poetry that we do in our teens maybe, or whatever, or if we're just sort of experimenting with language, like you said, like playing with alliteration or with assonance or consonants or whatever, that's the it could mean anything and who cares.
Right.
And there are songs that are like that too, where you go, wow, this is a really catchy song, and they you know, it's sort of the whole thing about how Elton John and Bernie Taupin had to work together because Elton John's lyrics were basically like, I don't know what to say.
Right.
I've got really great music and someone needs to put meaning to this, because otherwise what's the point? So yeah, to look at poetry and really say, in a powerful poem, and I want to go through some poems that meant something to us.
Ooh.
For a little bit. And I mean, I'll start with one that I did a rewrite of last week and posted on Facebook, kind of just as a laugh, but Fire and Ice by Robert Frost. The poem that has always stuck with me. It means a lot to me. It has a very clear message. It's not without room for interpretation, but it says what it means, right? It's going somewhere, and it's going somewhere and using the rhythm and the rhyme scheme and everything to present you with a lyrical depiction of a very grim take on humanity. And I always like that. Similarly, you got Ozymandias by Percy Shelley, mm-hmm. which is another one that I read that in sophomore or junior year of high school.
Yeah.
And that was a huge poem for me, because just the, you know, look on ye mighty at my works. Like that, just that energy is so amazing. And to, I don't know, it's weird, because it's sort of like there's a historical power to it, but it's also just that the beauty of it is it can reach through time and still mean a lot no matter what.
Yeah, and it's kind of especially like at that age, can I be like, oh, people always kind of like, if I'm remembering correctly, that it's look all you mighty, but it's like a rotted statue, right?
Yeah, like, it's only the feet of the statue remaining.
And as a kid, you're like, everything's supposed to be important and serious and blah, blah, blah. And this is, it's a nice window. It's like, oh, people kind of thought everything was bullshit way back then too. Like, yeah. Which is nice.
Yeah, it's nice to know that on one hand, whatever your parents think is important will not be important by the time you're their age. But right. It's also interesting to confront the idea that it really doesn't matter how powerful you think you are or how much of a legacy you've built for yourself, because literally a statue of a person who is an emperor has crumbled and only the feet remain.
Right.
And it's ironic that it says, hey, look upon my works. And it's like, all your works are gone, dummy. It doesn't matter what you do. So that stuck with me just because it's kind of part of my ethos. But yeah, what poems really, really hit you? Like, what, I mean, do you have anything that just, they stick with you, you always remember that you read that one day and you'll never forget it. You kind of quote it partially once in a while.
Yeah, I was very lucky when I was in grad school to be the grad assistant to the main poetry professor at Chapman University. And so part of my job was to, when they would have visiting poets, I'd take them to all their lectures and then hear them read a few times throughout the day. And so I got to meet Ada Limon, who lives out in Tennessee. And I, by the end of the day, I heard this one poem called The Conditional three times. And one was during a podcast. I was interviewing her, so I was like barely paying attention because I was like tech and sound levels and blah, blah, blah. And then another time, and by the third time I heard it that night, I was like openly crying, which is, I cry easily like at movies, but it's rare like that in the middle of a reading, that kind of thing. And that poem was actually read at my wedding because we're not religious, but it's all about, it's the final poem in her book, Bright Dead Things. And it's all about the world is ending, everything is shit, but like, look at us holding hands, watching it. Isn't that, how lucky are we? And just that attitude. I don't know if you and the listeners could tell, like that's generally my attitude to the things, is everything is bullshit, but why not enjoy the little parts? And,
yeah, I'm with you 100%. I mean, I think that's the big thing is sort of, I think one of the most romantic things in the world is just being with the person you love while the world burns. Anyway, mm-hmm. Because it's this sort of, you know, the scariest thing about anything ending is that you will be alone.
Yes.
We'll face it with no one, right? And it's much better to imagine like, oh, cool. Well, even if, you know, even if a nuclear bomb goes off and there's just this wave of energy that vaporizes us, we'll be here together vaporized.
Right. At least there's this. Yeah. So that one, and then I don't even know if I could. One of my favorite poets is Victoria Chang, who does like project poetry. Each book is very specific, which some people think like, isn't that every book? But no, some people are just like, here's what I wrote in the last 5 years. And yeah, she always has a very specific intent. So Barbie Chang is one of her more recent books. And she does do like that sonic play we're talking about, except that it fucking means so much in the way she uses assonance and consonants and repetition and circles back. And that every poem is kind of linked to every other poem within her work is bananas. So I don't have a specific one, but check out Barbie Chang in general, or her newest one is Obit, where each poem is an obituary for a concept.
Oh, wow.
And so, what? Yeah, it's a concept. Yeah.
Give me an example of a concept.
Memory is a lot. So, cause it deals with a lot of, a father's senility and then dying and a mother's death a few years before that. But it's like, so the death of memory, the death of brain, the death of love, the death of all the different hospice nurses who had come in and out in a period of time. And so death loosely, but made like grief and loss.
Yeah.
Of all these things. And so those are the major things that play within it, but it could be like of youth, of that there's kid, her kids are growing up in it. So it's like death of their childhood because they are growing up now and
innocence.
Yeah. Again, presses my buttons in the way that's like, even in all these good things, aren't things dying? Like,
yeah. I mean, but that's, you know, before we started the show, we were talking a little bit just kind of about the transitive nature of existence right now under the pandemic and everything, and sort of spending every day thinking like, well, okay, things might be getting better today, but in like 2 weeks, everything might be getting way worse. And we might be, you know, we're really forced right now to confront reality in a day by day way and understand that everything could change very rapidly. My dog Rocket's birthday was on the 13th of May.
Oh, happy birthday, Rocket!
Just three, the morbid but aware person I was petting him, and I just thought, well, shit. This might be about a quarter of the time that we'll spend together has passed.
Yes.
What that did was it caused me to be sad momentarily, but then it caused me to be very grateful. And even just thinking of it again, I'm like, it just makes me want to cherish this more, which is a good thing. And poetry is often that snapshot, right? It's often saying like, hey, you don't think about these things, but if you think about them, they're really valuable and important.
Yeah.
And they deserve to be put, you know, cemented in ink just so we don't lose them completely.
For sure. Yeah. It distills everything. So you don't get lost in all the tangents that didn't have to do with, like, if you're telling a story, you're like, oh, we were at Red Robin. No, we were at Sizzly. Like, you don't get lost in, like, it's just, here's the distillation. And the thing I was trying to tell you about is like this beautiful lunch I had with my dad 10 years ago. And now I'm not getting lost in it. It's here in 10 lines. And you know exactly what I'm trying to say. Yeah. And I think one of the things circling back that people trips them up, because it has to be momentous, it has to be huge, but I really like the small moment, even though the stuff I just talked about are the poems that give me feel like big moments. I tend to hate a lot of my work when I read it until a few years later, but a recent thing I wrote that I really like is just about why I get tattoos and my best friend who says he never will. And it's just a stupid, silly poem, but it's like trying to distill, like, it feels like frivolous or lame if I'm just like, here's why we're friends. But like, just to distill it in like a very narrow mindset, like, is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And it kind of comes back. It comes back to the whole issue of if you're looking at the world and your life from the lens of someone who's trying to write something out of it, you tend to notice things you wouldn't notice otherwise.
Right.
Like you're attending to the connection you and your friend have over this thing that you're completely on opposite ends of the spectrum on, but also it creates a lot of meaning. It points to probably the things that make you like each other, right?
Yeah, and that's right your way out, right? Like, you don't have to know everything. You shouldn't know. It should be fun. It should be a little mystery when you start to write. Maybe you have that line or general idea, but by the end of it, you should be like, oh, shit. Like, and helps you articulate why you love a thing.
Yeah, there's like the William Carlos Williams poem about
the plums.
Plums, that's right. I was trying to remember if it was plums. Yeah, about the plums, which is such a cliche thing to bring up, but at the same time, like, there is so much in that note, right? Mm-hmm. Like, thinking about another person when you're doing a thing and then observing the experience around the thing that you did in combination with your shame for doing it, which is
right.
Beautiful.
And talk about word economy. Like, there's so much of that you have to read that poem over and over and over. That's definitely one I did not in high school. It's like, so anything's poetry, this is stupid. And later I'm like, nah, that's so good. Like, because he doesn't say, and I'm shameful. You just have to like sit with it and be like, well, why would somebody write this and why in this order? And then,
yeah, why would you?
So nice and so cold.
Yeah. It's like a note that you leave on somebody's car because you hit them while you were parking and you just want to apologize, right? Like, hey, I cracked your turn signal. It wasn't fun. I apologize. Like, whatever. There's another poem. Have you read a lot of Sharon Olds?
No.
Okay.
I know the name, but I have not read.
There's a poem called I Couldn't Tell that's one of hers that is a beautiful, just, it's another one of those things where it's chronicling a moment, and it's, I think it's probably like 40 lines. It's not long, but it just captures this moment of youth and, you know, the passage of time, the fleetness of youth, all these things. It's a very simple scene about sitting together and eating, right? Like, it's just powerful stuff.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about poetry. Like, a novel could spend 300 pages telling you what it's about, and it'll do so through very long conversations where people are either forcefully expositional or intentionally obtuse. And then you get to the end and you go, ah, I get it. I know what you were saying, Michael Crichton. We dinosaurs. Good call. but yeah, I mean, poetry is just brilliant. I mean,
I don't want to put everything into competition, but that is who I am. So like, it is, I still read novels, just not that much. And it's like, oh, it took you that long? Like, it does feel like, oh, I have, in poetry, if each word is worth $10, you really have to decide your word. And fiction, it's like, each word's 10 cents. I can say whatever I want. You're like, you still could have trimmed a bunch of this shit. Like, just.
I mean, that's, yeah, as someone who edits books for our own press, and then, you know, I've written novels myself, like, the battle is always the joy of the scene or the sequence that you're putting together and what it means. Cause I tend to think about when I'm writing fiction, I tend to write cinematically or serial television style. I'm thinking about well, if this book was a season of a show, what would this season be about?
Yeah.
This book, right? So it's like some chapters might not seem related to everything, but the whole experience is supposed to be, okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Thing. Poetry has the beautiful benefit of you can have a book of 50 poems that address all the shapes and angles of one issue, but in almost unrecognizable ways from one another.
Yeah.
And still be so functional. Where, yeah, I mean, my point is, I guess, that a traditional narrative is restrictive in that you're going to have a hard time outside of, say, like a short story collection. But even then, you know, a lot of people would probably say, oh, if you had a very experimental short story collection where you wrote every chapter is a different character seeing the same thing.
Oh, I like right?
that. Like, this is cool, but also, why did you do this, right?
Yeah.
In sort of the way that, I don't know, God, what's that book called? There's a Chuck Palahniuk book that pretty much is that. It's a group of people who have all been brought to a writer's retreat and...
Drowning? It's something with water, right?
Well, there's a guy in there who, he like gets off by sitting on the bottom of the pool on the
suction. Yes.
Which is the thing where a lot of people fainted when Palahniuk read it in meetings at bookstores.
Haunting or haunted? I'm looking this up now.
I think it's haunted. I think that's right. But yeah, so you that book does that, but it's also, that book isn't one of my favorite that I've read of his because it does that a little too much.
Right.
People I don't really care about. And then that makes the central premise flimsier and flimsier because then you're like, well, all these people are way too disastrously awful to have been brought together intentionally. And then it's like, oh, no, it was intentional, but it was also, anyway, I don't want to
spoil. Yeah, when it becomes, you're like, oh, this was an exercise, and that's cool. But, like, it's exercises are very important, but it's like, how do you hide it? Going back to, like, I feel like I've said a lot of things arrogantly. I'm like, I do that all the time. I'm an overwriter. All my stuff starts off too long, and I do the sonic play that means nothing a lot. But, like, it's like, that's good. That's just, like, your training for the real stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, may we both be so lucky as to have you know, Palahniuk's opportunity to do an
excellent right.
novel and be compensated for it. But yeah, it really, I mean, it same thing with like Stephen King for that matter, who I love a lot of Stephen King's books, but I also know that probably 60% of Stephen King's books are rewrites of the other 40%.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all overlong because no one's going to restrict him on word count or page count. They want like, just send us a manuscript. We'll put your name on it. It's done. And a poet will never have that. I don't know who it is. Like there, no poet who is alive has that level of clout. You know, like even, you know, even if Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who is like our last living beat, like comes out and says, here, I've come up with the best book of poetry ever. It's 5,000 pages. They'd be like, you got to cut this down.
Yeah. That's five volumes maybe. Yeah. It's, And that's part of like, I like the humbling of that. I like that, like, the greats and the titans of poetry, you're going to see them at readings and they're just going to be like people in like a shabby, weird, furry old coat. And you're like, yeah, you just look like a normal weirdo. Like, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. God, that is a nice thing, I guess. Poets will never probably reach a point of elitism.
I think there's young ones that can, right? Because they win a prize, which is awesome. They sell books, which is awesome. But then you're like, okay, just please remember what you're bragging about right now. You're the biggest fish in poetry. Like,
yeah, and somebody could be that big fish, but it usually doesn't last. I mean, I know several poets who are extraordinarily talented, and I would do anything if I had the power to make it so that they could just live off of their poetry.
Right.
Just like reading it when I get to. But you know, everybody has to teach, right? If you're a poet, you teach.
You're teaching.
Or you're something else, right?
Right. Teaching or copywriting I feel like that's part of maybe the inherent beauty of it is because like publishing poetry takes a little longer because it doesn't make money. So you are constantly tapped into like the normal world and real life and the day-to-day drudgery. And that's just like fuel, right? Like you're just,
that's what creates the poetry because if
right.
I mean, if you had David Geffen's yacht and you were just riding out Corona in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, like, you're not writing any poetry because you're just framing yourself and drinking champagne that gets, I guess, droned in. I don't know.
I think it's the same thing when stand-up comedians get huge. Their stuff is less funny because it's less relatable because they're no longer riding the bus or getting stuck in traffic or whatever. They're helicoptering from stadium to stadium. And you're like, oh, you're just not funny anymore.
What's the deal with private jets?
I don't know, man. I probably never will.
Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I mean, that is really the bottom line, right? Like, poetry has this incredible power to, one, it can be so cathartic. Like, and I think that's sort of the gift for any individual, layperson, whatever, is you can just sit down and write poetry and go with the it doesn't have to mean anything thing, and you can get a lot of emotions out. Like, you can drain yourself of long fears or self-doubt or whatever, and then if you want to focus on it, you can really distill something powerful out of that, and possibly even brilliant, depending, you know. But it's sort of, to one extent, you know, you said this before, like, everybody thinks they can write and they can't, but everybody can attempt poetry.
Yes.
Which is beautiful. It doesn't require, like, oh, man, I gotta write 1,000 words a day so I can get through, and in 50 days I'll have this novel length book done. Mm-hmm. And maybe some of it'll be good. Maybe I'll have to throw most of it away. With poetry, at least you can go, well, you know what? I got a couple hours. I'll just sit down and write some stuff. I mean, I've written a bunch of lyrics that are pretty much all angry political punk kind of, while we've been dealing with this. Like, I wrote something called Steak Place. I'll just read you the first stanza. Slave every single day to save for a rainy day. It won't matter anyway. Took all the money yesterday and gave it to a steak place. My response to the PPP thing with whatever that steak plate, Ruth Chris's.
Ruth Chris, yeah. Yeah, I could see early anti-flag.
Yeah.
Thinking that, yeah.
I thought about trying to put like a little record to get a little EP together, but we'll see what I do. But yeah, like, you can sit down and just sort of enjoy that and enjoy. There's whimsy to poetry, I guess, is my point. Like, mm-hmm. Poetry can give you some, you're playing, you can play a little bit more.
And that's constantly going back to why people don't like it, because they think it's very sad sack and emo. But yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff. Derek Brown is also a publisher of Right Bloody Press. His shit's super funny. One of his, I wish I remember the name of the poem, but he has one poem about getting jerked off on the Peter Pan ride on Disneyland.
Okay.
And it's super funny. And there's a line that's just like, tiny London's looking at you while you're getting a hand job on. It's super funny. And my wife and I scream that line at each other all of the time.
Oh, man. Yeah. Bryce Mayero, who he's part of South Broadway Press here in town. And I sent you his name, so hopefully you guys will connect, because I think he should read on your series. But he had a poem that he read. This was now 2 Decembers ago. We did a little reading at the co-working space where my office is-ish, used to be-ish. And he a brilliant poem about a kind of a person living inside, I think living inside like a melon or something like that. I'm really butchering this. So Bryce, I apologize if you listen to the show and you're like, what the fuck? You don't know what I'm talking about. But it's hilarious, but also very heartfelt and meaningful. Like, it, like poetry in those, you know, 10 lines, 20 lines can give you a laugh and then also leave you thinking and make you sad and bring you back out of all of it.
Right.
In a way that nothing else can. And I mean, that's, you know, it is like a song that way, but even a song tends to be like, no song really switches frequently between major and minor, just to jerk you around. But a poem can do that. A poem can do that really effectively. I guess because it's just so grounded.
Yeah, it's grounded. It's short, and it like it does feel like if it's not doing that, like maybe do another draft. Like, it doesn't need to make you feel everything, but a few things.
Yeah, fine tune. Give us a little bit of time. let's see. I'm trying to think if there's any. I don't have a whole lot else on the. Okay. Here's something. What do you hate about poetry? We've talked a lot about.
So much
about poetry.
So, like, again, I feel very odd, and it's happening more and more because I'm becoming known as a poet. But I hated it up until 6 years ago, and that's not a lot of my life of enjoying it. What I don't hate, you don't have to be an expert. If guys just get into poetry, gals just get it and read it and write it, and you don't have to know. I'm an idiot about it, but I can still pretend to talk like an expert on the show. So that's something I like. What I don't like is the people who truly believe everything is poetry, and so there's no effort there. I don't want to read a journal entry. I don't care about your diary. Like, if you're publishing or at a reading or at a mic, have some editing. I don't cotton to the I'm just going to scream my feelings. Anytime that I was like, okay, where's the lyricism? Where's the metaphor? What are we doing here? Are you going to, no, you just wrote about how angry you were and at no point was a surprise where this is going. Cool. And I think that could be very important in your private life. I think more people should write out their feelings, but like, don't think just because you wrote a thing down, it means other people should hear it or read it.
Yeah, that's the catharsis problem, right? That it's like, well, yeah, right. This served a purpose for me, so therefore it must serve a purpose for other people. Not true.
So that's one thing I hate. It's the opposite end of the spectrum. I do hate pretension. Like, I think it's very interesting that, like, in the 90s, the poetry intelligista, whoever that was at the time, was like, well, slam's not real poetry. And it totally is. And then it happened with slam, and then it happened with, like, Def Jam style poetry. And then the latest one, I don't like her stuff that much. But I think it's great what Rupi Kaur is doing. But so many people are like, "Ugh, fuck that. Get a real book of poetry." And it's like, motherfucker, that's how people will. Like, yeah. She's the biggest selling poet right now. They're going to go to Barnes & Noble. They're going to read Milk and Honey and Thistle and Whistle, whatever. Like, she has it very cute and packaged and is really smart. And you're going to read that and be like, oh, what's the next thing? I saw Bad Religion in the Blink-182 show, and then I found out what real punk was. Like, there's these baby steps, and they're awesome.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point, too, because we can't. There's closed-mindedness in that elitism and in that sort of, you know, elevating whatever what's art, right? Mm-hmm. Elevating art beyond the reach of anybody. So they like, well, we don't make any money, but we're still better than you because no one can do what we do. And it's like, well, that doesn't serve any function. Like, the point of this, why write it down if it's not to communicate something?
And jealousy is a huge part because we don't make any money. So it's like, well, I'm not going to make money. So the clout is what I'll hold on to, and the cooler, and who cares? And again, I think poetry is selling more and more in the last few years. I'd bet all my not money I have from making poetry, that Rupi Kaur is a huge part of that. Like,
oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, because people need an entry point, right? Mm-hmm. They need something to connect with. Jewel's poetry books sold crazy well, right? And I don't think either of us would say that Jewel is an excellent poet.
No, I was gonna, I can't even, I'm blanking out. I was gonna sing a line of one of her songs.
Who Will Save Your Soul?
Who Will Save Your Soul, yes. but yeah, it's probably not great, but if somebody reads it and like, oh, what else is there? And then you just keep going and keep digging and find it and find the cool bookstores like Powell's or The Strand or Tattered, like, and they have massive, pretty great poetry sections.
Well, there's this thing too, which is, I mean, it comes from the academic aspect of it, but poetry that doesn't require a lot of work is still valid. Mm-hmm. And it should be, because I think, you know, one of the poems that, The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot means a lot to me. The first book that I published I did a contemporized rewrite of The Wasteland that sort of was all, indie rock references in place of the Greek mythology and stuff like that.
That's awesome.
And that poem in its original form requires a bunch of looking stuff up. If you really want to get, if you really want to know, because if you're not a person who is going through university, you know, high school or university in the 1910s, 1920s, you're not going to get everything. But if you do that work, it's really interesting because it's all about just, well, where do we find ourselves? We're lost. And it's interesting because we're equally lost now. But like that academic component seems to be part of the disqualification, right? That if this doesn't require work or doesn't require a pedigree to understand or didn't come through a program with a pedigree, it can't be good. And in a lot of cases, that is true, that it's not good. But
that doesn't mean it can't be.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Like, well, because yeah, that's the any medium that anybody can do it. Because I'm a big podcaster, love podcasting, but I have the same issues with podcasting as poetry. The minute anybody can do it, that's awesome. The Wild West, punk rock, motherfucker. But at the same time, anyone can do it. So there's going to be a lot of trash and not very much trying, just people who want attention. Bummer.
No, I agree. Because we like having gatekeepers for the purposes of maintaining quality, right? There needs to be some sort of quality. There needs to be some sort of understanding that there is a purpose behind this other than it can be done.
Right. But there's so much great accessible. I feel like it can be more accessible than like academic poets these days, but there's so much great accessible poets. Eric Morago and Mindy Netafi and Kristen Aptowitz and Buddy Wakefield all are writing like, you don't have to study poetry. You could read it like, I totally get why this poem about Thor getting drunk and losing his hammer, why it's hilarious and very sad at the same time. Like, you don't need to study the forms.
Yeah. Yeah. Because really the analysis that we talked about earlier, when you're talking about meter and diction and rhyme scheme and scansion and everything, like you're not, that is the math part of poetry. Mm-hmm. And you have to, you need to know the math, because if you don't, you don't really understand what the point is. Because otherwise you're really just writing a paragraph and arbitrarily entering line break.
That used to, yes. But it's not arbitrary. That's the difference. If you're like, oh, suddenly both of those lines mean four things because they broke it right there.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the beauty. And that's sort of the thing that's interesting too, that I think poetry is so compelling, because if somebody reads a novel, or if they read or if they do a table read of a script, the meaning is pretty much clear in there. Mm-hmm. But if you go to a poetry reading, the poet will show you a meaning that maybe you didn't get.
Yeah.
Read it on the page, and you might get a different reading on the page simply because of the way the poem is structured. And there's something really beautiful in that, because it's really the idea that, and this is going to sound very pretentious, but there's a lot of value in the parts of the page that don't have text on them as well.
Oh yeah. Does sound pretentious. And I agree.
Yeah. I mean, you're reading through this and you go, oh, there's only one word on this line. And then there's five line breaks. And then we get another thing and you go, oh yeah, there's a breath there. It's either a pregnant pause. There's meaning. Everything is connected. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get the feeling that it's the ascension of a roller coaster, and other times it's just free falling. But it all depends on the language, and no other medium does that as effectively.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with everything you said, and it reminded me of another thing I hate about poetry.
Yeah,
when people are reading, because like part of what brought me to is because I was a failed stand-up comic, quit that, right? And nonfiction, there's not a big community, there's not a lot of nonfiction performances, which is what I was writing in school. So I love attention. Started going to poetry readings, and what I call the Iowa voice or the MFA voice, I don't know if that's where it originated, but I have noticed more academic poets versus towny poets tend to lean, you're gonna read like this, so everybody knows exactly where the line break is, and it's you gotta thread that needle, walk in the bounds beam of line breaks do matter, but please don't take that weird breath that's super performative every time there's a line break. Like, it's, you gotta.
Yeah, my experience in high school was the teacher I had told us basically, like, you read straight until you hit punctuation. Mm-hmm. I don't care how many line breaks there are, keep going until you hit something that tells you you're supposed to stop. And that would be a period. Like,
And, I feel like that's too extreme because you're like, okay, they like I want to pause somewhere. But when it's every time in like short poems, you're like, all right, you are going to hyperventilate up there.
There is that sort of thing, because I think there is an old T.S. Eliot recording that I would mimic, and I can't think of a line, but it's, well, I guess I can think of April is the cruelest month, right? Where you get this sort of every word is hit so hard on purpose to over-accentuate it. And then there's the performative, to your point, like performativeness begins to take away from the writing, because eventually you're just like, oh, I'm watching you do this. I'm not really even listening to the words you're saying because I'm watching you do this.
Right. Now,
that's not every time, of course, but it's a thing that happens. I've definitely been to readings where I'm like, this poem's really good, but I wish you wouldn't have read it that way.
Yeah. You're like, you're trying to sell it a little too much. And I do think the opposite side, because I know poets who I'm just going to read like this because it's the words that are important. So I'm going to read very monotone and never, I'm like, all right, just show them the book then. Like the book can do that. Like, so you do have to find that balance of like, I want to sell it just enough and like figure out how to do that. Like, I'm going to make it hurt again because that's what sells it. Because like,
right.
But without going too big to take them out of it and be like, oh, you really practiced this. But that means, I don't know, probably practice a lot so you can do it enough and not do the over performative thing. What I always think of is, so I married an axe murderer. That's what the bad readers, the Harriet, sweet Harriet, like that. And you're like,
that's a very good example. And it's interesting because, you know, a lot of times writer types are going to be maybe a little more introverted. So they're not going to maybe be the type of person who's going to perform a lot of times over and over and over again to figure out how to do something a certain way. But it also depends on the nature of their poetry too.
Right.
Lots of people have a Dickinson sort of perspective on writing poetry, and it's hopefully not just the journaling that you mentioned earlier, but
right.
Something that's like, hey, I don't really need to share this with anybody performatively, but it still has a value, or it's still been finely tuned.
Selection matters. There's some pieces that like are great never out loud. Let those just stay on page.
I think about I'm trying to think like Yeah, long pause. Oh, well.
It was intentional. Think about it. Think about everything we just said.
Take a moment. Really take this in. I want to talk about, you know, there's Mending Wall by Robert Frost, which is one of those poems that seems to be in the, as well as the road Less Taken, where these are poems that seemed to have a meaning when I was younger. And then as I learned about what poetry was and how it worked, they took on new meaning.
Yeah.
Are there any poems that you can think of in your life that maybe were like, wow, this is one thing. And then you got older and reread it and went, wow, this was really actually something else.
Yeah. We talked about one of them already is the Icebox or whatever, the Plums. Carlos Williams, that and the... So cannot remember the name of that one. So that one, and there's so much to say about A Red Wheelbarrow.
And
I really did not get the minimalism of what he was doing. And then my wife's grandparents just moved and they had to get rid of a bunch of books. And so I took a bunch of they had a lot of poetry books, and I'm reading a collection of his and rereading it now. Instead of being an idiot 17-year-old, I'm like, oh, no, okay. Rock on, I get it. Like... And there's a great movie, Patterson with Adam Driver, about his love of William Carlos Williams that I think helps if you're like, I never got why that Icebox poem mattered. Watch that movie. Like, it really helps distill it and his love.
Right on. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think those, you know, those two Frost poems, and then I've even looked back at, like, you know, Dr. Seuss and Silverstein, right? And you go back and go, oh, wow, there's a lot of darkness in this that I didn't get when I was a kid, because there's whimsy and the whimsy overpower the darkness. And then you go back and go, oh, this is real. These are real feelings, real, you know, complex situations.
Yeah. Shel Silverstein, especially, like, really, really got dark and was great for Sad little kids. I'm trying to think, yeah, because I haven't really gone back, other than the William Carlos Williams, that often to the stuff from like high school days. And I feel like that, I think that is a current failing. Like, I'm like, I should go back and like just dive into Dickinson again, because it's been 15 years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the sort of thing that would we have infinite time, we would do that. But you kind of go, I really want to check out this new thing because it's new and I want to be connected to what's going on, because that's the only way to form my writing.
There's so much great new stuff.
Yeah.
And people pushing you, like, and because you should read poetry different. Like, I try to read it every night. I'm not great at it, but the minute you start flipping the pages like you're reading a novel, it's like, oh, put it down and go back a few pages the next day because you missed everything.
Yeah, you weren't looking at each thing, because it is poetry ends up being. You had mentioned looking at a painting, right? And you stand there, look at it for a long time to make it seem like you're
yeah,
what's going on. But poetry really requires that, right? Like, you really do have to sit and look and reread lines and even look at the way that the words are arranged on the page, because it does matter.
Yeah.
You can totally, you know, you'll unlock these just kind of wonderful little mysteries that are just interlaced in there.
And I will say, do that unless all of that sounds atrocious, and then burn through it. And then the important ones will stick, and then you'll go back later again. Like, again, everything is about like breaking the barriers of it, because there's so many. That's anytime a long running show I hosted in Long Beach was at this rock and roll bar, and it was called Poetry on the Rocks, and it was just, normally there was like punk bands and rock bands on stage, but nobody was there Wednesday night, so they gave it to us, and the poets had to do a shot, and then they were allowed to read their poems. And it's because I used to hate it, so I get why somebody does. And so I'm like, no, it's not quiet coffee shop library time. Like, it could be fun and like raucous and a good old time.
Yeah, that's the punketry thing here, which,
yes,
come back when we can gather in public places again, although Three Kings is shutting down, so that's a real bummer. But yeah, like, punketry is one of those things where it's like, we're just gonna play music and you read your poetry to that music. I think that's really powerful. Because it doesn't have to be like nasally guy standing at the dais, slowly trudging through five pages of meter. Like, it needs to be, no, these are human emotions. These are real things happening. The point of this is that this is a snapshot of life. Like, a poem is a photograph in the way that a novel is a flip book, you know? Like, let's get into it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for being on the podcast this week. This has been a lot of fun, and hopefully the listeners have enjoyed us rambling about poetry.
I hope so. And again, if you didn't, I get it. Can I tell them things they should check out if they're like,
I was just going to set you up. So do some plugs.
So this isn't for me. Just like, if you are interested in poetry and haven't delved deep, some of the names I mentioned before, I think are great to check out. People like Eric Murago, and Mindy Netafi, Derek Brown, Kristen Aptowitz, Victoria Chang, Ada Limon, Saeed Jones, who got me into it. Kudzu is his poem that like broke me and is going to be my next tattoo the minute we're legally and safely allowed to get tattoos. Mindy Netafi has a like craft book called Glitter in the Blood that walks you very unpretentiously how to write poems. So check that out. And now I'm allowed to be selfish.
Yeah.
Plug my stuff. If you want to hear this voice not talk about poetry, but maybe about superhero television, check out the Superhero Show, where every week we cover literally every single live action TV show based on comic books. We started when there was four of them, and we're like, oh, we should do this. And now there's 1,000 every week. There's also the OCD, where I go episode by episode through the OC, and Movie of the Year, where we pick a year and then put 8 top movies into a bracket and find that movie that actually encapsulates that year. I think those are all of the ones for now.
Nice. Well, and there's the show that I'm going to be on.
Yes. That's Movie of the Year. We're doing bonus episodes of movies that were supposed to come out in theaters and did not. And you and I, after we hang up on the podcast, are going to talk about what movie you want to watch. But poetry. Pink Noise is a virtual reading and open mic that's nationwide, because now with the internet, it's great. Everybody's changing their open mics and readings online. But so many people are still like, well, I know these bits of it was a Dallas open mic, so now they're still all Dallas poets. And it's me and three other poets from across the country who are like, wait, we know each other. We all know people from different places. Let's make like a truly nationwide poetry thing. So it's been a weird, cool experiment every other Saturday. Look up Pink Noise on Facebook.
It's awesome too. and maybe I'll read sometime if I haven't.
Yes, please.
I think my greatest concern is that a lot of my poems feel like they could be a poet. They could be anything. And I don't want to go on and be that guy. I would plug, I have some very good friends. Brian Dixon is an exceptional poet. He is here in Denver. Jennifer Moore is in Ohio. She is a phenomenal poet. I don't know what else to plug, because honestly, the thing is like, just go out and find some poetry and try reading it. I mean, even if it just means that you pull an album off your shelf and read the lyrics to yourself without trying to hear the song, but just reading for comprehension.
I miss doing that. I feel as a kid, I would get the album and just like read the lyrics over and over, like with it playing in the background, but like very disconnected from the song playing. So it is its own entity. And like, I don't have the attention span to do that anymore.
Oh no. We live in an era of too many things and too many options. But yeah, poetry is great and everybody should check it out. And listeners, if you like this podcast, I would encourage you to subscribe if you haven't, and rate and review us. That would be great. And also check out our social media stuff. We got a Facebook group. We've got a Twitter at A Vague Idea Pod, and we've got an Instagram at A Vague Idea Podcast. And we will eventually go back to doing the game as a game show, as it was originally conceived, when that is safe to do.
This was fun. I would love to come back to do that, because I like dumb competition.
Oh yeah, no, I would. I want to have you back on, Mike, for the game show part, especially. I mean, I'd have you back on for this Zoom conversation, because this has been a lot of fun. I mean, I love it. You know, as much as the world needs two white guys rambling on about what's art and what isn't.
Has that happened before?
We've done it. I heard something. I saw something on the white guy forum that someone else had already done it.
Oh no.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I would like to have you on the podcast in its more regular iteration too. So that would be phenomenal.
Yes, and people can hear us talk again very soon.
That's right. You need to hear us, and you will hear us louder and with better sound quality and more engineering and production. So yeah, listeners, thank you guys so much. We'll be with you next week. Stay safe, be well, wash your hands, and talk to you later. Bye-bye!
A Vague Idea is written and produced by me, Nate Regolia, with Shannon Page, and sometimes John Perros. Information about topics often come from Wikipedia, so hey, why not donate a bit to that? Sound effects are Creative Commons public domain. If you like this podcast, tell a few people, and subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen. And if you happen to like reading science fiction, check out the small press I started with my friend Sean Grokowski. You can find Spaceboy books at readspaceboy.com.